As you know, our speaker is Tim Krupa, and his subject is We Have Seen the Kingdom Stone. Tim, please.
Each era of the gospel age has been unique in its own sense. Each era has been difficult to live in. I'm sure the early church had experiences that we do not have. The church of the Middle Ages, church of the 1800s, they've all had special trials and tribulations. But in some respects, perhaps, the end of the age is the worst time to live. There are more evils abounding. Satan is working harder. As it says in 2 Timothy, the third chapter, the apostle says that the last days are perilous times. So we live in those days. There's more evil. There are more seductions from the world. There's more temptation. There is more distraction than at any other time during God's plan, especially during this gospel age. So I think in order to compensate for that, God has given us special blessings for those of us who are living at this time period. He has allowed you and me to see things much more clearly than any other time period of the gospel age. We can see things with the eye of faith so clearly now that we almost walk by sight and not by faith. I think he's done this to compensate for these terrible times in which we're living. We have had the privilege of seeing prophecy fulfilled right in front of our eyes in our lifetime. One of the things that you and I have seen fulfilled by the eye of faith is our topic today. And that is the kingdom stone. We have seen the kingdom stone. Let us read from Daniel, the second chapter. I'm going to be reading from the New International Translation. In the second year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His mind was troubled, and he could not sleep. So the king summoned the magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, and astrologers to tell him what he had dreamed. When they came in and stood before the king, he said to them, "I have had a dream that troubles me, and I want to know what it means." Then the astrologers answered the king in Aramaic, "O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will interpret it." The king replied to the astrologers, "This is what I have firmly decided. If you do not tell me my dream, what my dream was, and interpret it, I will have you cut into pieces and your houses turned into piles of rubble. But if you tell me the dream and explain it, you will receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor. So tell me the dream and interpret it for me." Once more they replied, "Let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will interpret it." Then the king answered, "I am certain that you are trying to gain time, because you realize that this is what I have firmly decided. If you do not tell me the dream, there is just one penalty for you. You have conspired to tell me misleading and wicked things, hoping the situation will change. So then, tell me the dream, and I will know that you can interpret it for me. The astrologers answered the king, "There is not a man on earth who can do what the king asks. No king, however great and mighty, has ever asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or astrologer. What the king asks is too difficult. No one can reveal it to the king except the gods, and they do not live among men." This made the king so angry and furious that he ordered the execution of all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree was issued to put the wise men to death, and men were sent to look for Daniel and his friends and to put them to death. When Arioch, the commander of the king's guard, had gone out to put to death the wise men of Babylon, Daniel spoke to him with wisdom and tact. He asked the king's officer, "Why did the king issue such a harsh decree?" Arioch then explained the matter to Daniel. At this, Daniel went in to the king and asked for time so that he might interpret the dream for him. Then Daniel returned to his house and explained the matter to his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. He urged them to plead for mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that he and his friends might not be executed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. During the night, the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision. Then Daniel praised the God of heaven. Then Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to execute the wise men of Babylon, and said to him, "Do not execute the wise men of Babylon. Take me to the king, and I will interpret the dream for him." Arioch took Daniel to the king at once and said, "I have found a man among the exiles from Judah who can tell the king what his dream means." The king asked Daniel, "Are you able to tell me what I saw in my dream and interpret it?" Daniel replied, "No wise man, enchanter, magician, or diviner can explain to the king the mystery he has asked about. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. He has shown King Nebuchadnezzar what will happen in the days to come. Your dream and the visions that pass through your mind as you lay on your bed are these. As you were lying there, O king, your mind turned to things to come, and the revealer of mysteries showed you what is going to happen. As for me, this mystery has been revealed to me not because I have greater wisdom than other living men, but so that you, O king, may know the interpretation and that you may understand what went through your mind. You looked, O king, and there before you stood a large statue, an enormous, dazzling statue, awesome in appearance. The head of the statue was made of pure gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of baked clay. While you were watching, a rock was cut out, but not by human hands. It struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and smashed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were broken to pieces at the same time and became like chaff on a threshing floor in the summer. The wind swept them away without leaving a trace. But the stone that struck the statue became a huge mountain and filled the whole earth. This was the dream, and now we will interpret it to the king. You, O king, are the King of Kings. The God of heaven has given you dominion and power and might and glory. In your hands He has placed mankind and the beasts of the field and the birds of the air. Wherever they live, He has made you ruler over them all. You are that head of gold. After you, another kingdom will rise, inferior to yours. Next, a third kingdom, one of bronze, will rule over the whole earth. Finally, there will be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron, for iron breaks and smashes everything. And as iron breaks things to pieces, so it will crush and break all the others. Just as you saw that the feet and toes were partly of baked clay and partly of iron, so this will be a divided kingdom. Yet it will have some of the strength of iron in it, even as you saw iron mixed with clay. As the toes were partly iron and partly clay, so this kingdom will be partly strong, but partly brittle. And just as you saw the iron mixed with baked clay, so the people will be a mixture and will not remain united any more than iron mixes with clay. In the time of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed. Nor will it be left to another people. It will crush all those kingdoms and bring them to an end. But it will itself endure forever. This is the meaning of the vision of the stone cut out of a mountain, but not by human hands. A stone that broke the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold to pieces. The great God has shown the king what will take place in the future. The dream is true, and the interpretation trustworthy. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell prostrate before Daniel and paid him honor in order that an offering and incense be presented to him. The king said to Daniel, "Surely your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings and the revealer of mysteries, for you were able to reveal the mystery." This dramatic story, this illustration, is an overview, a summary of how the world was to be ruled for a period of time. This story of Nebuchadnezzar's image shows that a succession of universal powers would rule until God's kingdom forcefully removes them. These rulers were from the Gentiles, from the heathens. This was a change. This was something new. God had not dealt with the heathen before, had not given them any authority to rule over the earth. God first dealt with individuals, ancient men. Then He dealt with the nation of Israel. But now He was saying, with Gentile kings. This period that was beginning with Nebuchadnezzar could be called the Gentile period. Or it could be called the age of the Gentiles, or perhaps the era of the Gentiles. Or you might use another expression and call it the Gentile times, because the Gentiles were going to rule with God's permission. The Gentile times was an expression
used by Jesus. Luke, the 21st chapter and 24th verse, they referred to the time period when Israel would specifically be unfavored. We see in Ezekiel 21, verses 25 through 27, the removal of the crown from Zedekiah. The diadem was being removed. And any dealing that Jehovah was having with Israel as a nation was coming to an end at that time period. Leviticus 26, verses 17 and 18, Jehovah predicted and promised that he would punish them seven times. He would not deal with the nation of Israel for seven times. Based on the concept of one day equals one year, in Ezekiel 4, verses 1 through 8, Israel was going to be punished for their national disobedience for seven times, or a time period of 2,520 years. So these two periods were talking about the same thing. They were talking about a period, a new period, of Gentile dominion. That same time period, and by definition, meant that Israel lost its dominion. Israel was not in favor. And in Luke, the Master tells us that this entire time period would see Jerusalem being downtrodden. It would not exist as a major force. It would not exist as an Israelite force in the world. But you notice that the time was limited. The image lived for a while and then was destroyed. The time period of disfavor to Israel was limited. There was promise that there would be an end. And as a matter of fact, and as a matter of no coincidence, both illustrations end the same way. The image is destroyed by the kingdom that God will set up. The period of Israel's disfavor ends by the coming of the deliverer. Zion shall come the deliverer and turn away ungodliness from Jacob. Both of these concepts, both of these illustrations, both of these labels of time periods represent the same thing, the same time period, but they do not represent the entire plan of God. This time period is a smaller, specific time period. There was a time period before this when God did other things, when he dealt with individuals, with the nation of Israel. But at this point in time, now God was starting to deal with the Gentiles. This time period doesn't show everything. It's a limited picture. It's limited in time. It's limited in location. It's limited in the individuals with which it deals. This picture does not show the picture of all time. This picture does not show all locations, such as heaven and earth. This picture does not show all individuals. It doesn't show the development of the church class through the gospel age, things like that. And we should acknowledge and reference that these doctrines and teachings are clearly set forth in the second volume of the Scripture Studies, especially in chapter 4. You have heard the story of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. You have heard Daniel's interpretation of it. You are familiar with the concepts of Gentile times, with 2,520 years as a chronological time period. As we now look from 1990, what do we have here? Do we have a prophecy? Do we have a dream? I would say no. As we look from this time period, we have a reality. We have something that has taken place in our lifetimes. And so we see it by the eye of faith. Emphasizing again, chapter 2, starting with verse 31. You looked, O king, and there stood before you a large statue, an enormous, dazzling statue, awesome in appearance. The head of the statue was made of pure gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of baked clay. While you were watching, a rock was cut out, but not by human hands. It struck the statue on the feet of iron and clay and smashed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were broken to pieces at the same time and became like chaff on the threshing floor in the summer. The wind swept them away without leaving a trace, but the stone that struck the statue became a huge mountain and filled the whole earth. We have seen in our lifetime this stone, which represents God's kingdom, we have seen it be activated. We have seen the 2,520 years of exclusive Gentile lease of power come to an end. But to understand these things, we must remember how God works. We must remember some of his principles. First of all, God has a lot of time. You know, a day with the Lord is like 1,000 years to us. And I didn't just make that up. Someone else has said that several times before. Things that you and I would try to accomplish in 2 or 3 weeks, God takes thousands of years. You know, at the first advent, the disciples thought it was time right then to set up the kingdom. But that's not how God operates. He actually took something like 2,000 years to select a bride class. The disciples would have done it in a couple weeks. Another thing that God does is he works via gradual processes. A series of actions or events. He works through succession of changes. And that's exactly what the expression means, God's plan. He has a plan. One thing follows another. You know, if he was instantaneously going to set up the solution, you wouldn't need much of a plan. Bang! You just throw in the solution. Who needs a plan if you're just going to impose the solution? But no, God uses natural consequences of events. He overrules things. He supervises, directs. But he never forces, never does he have instantaneous miracles. No steps are skipped. He's very efficient in using educational processes of this type of change. Take, for example, the restoration of Israel. Did he do it in a week? Did he do it in a year? No, he took years to slowly reseed Israel back in their homeland. And again, we refer to the completion of the church. God works through gradual processes. No instantaneous bang, flash, miracle. It doesn't work that way. Also, we see that God gives to us highlights of events. He tells us that certain events will take place. They're dramatic events. They're key events. They're keyed in the Scriptures. But in most cases, these events only mark the beginning or the end of what's going on. Too many times, we look at an event and we say, ah, that's the whole thing. Again, they looked at Jesus' life here on earth, the first advent. Many thought that was the entire story. No, it was just the beginning of the age. Some people make the same mistake at the Day of Judgment. They expect it to be over the Day of Judgment, starting with the time of trouble. Bam, it will be over, 24 hours. No, that's just the beginning of a 1,000-year process. So as we look at this story of the image, whatever we see as a beginning and an ending, we should not make the mistake that that's the whole story. No, these are beginnings of processes. These are ends. Things will gradually fade in and out of existence. So whatever we see happening with this incredible story and this chronological proof of the stone, we will try to remember that unlike us, God takes His time. One of the most significant teachings presented by Brother Russell, and it was really an incredible prediction, was that the Gentile times would end in 1914. That the image of Nebuchadnezzar would be struck in 1914. In the enthusiasm of that doctrine, Brother Russell also thought that God's kingdom would be established in 1914. It was nice that he lived enough years to see that not all those things were going to take place that soon. But based on a date of Israel's captivity beginning in 606 BC, the 2,520 years of the Gentile times indeed did end in 1914. To the eye of faith, the kingdom stone of Daniel's second chapter struck that image in 1914. Historians, political scientists, sociologists all say that something incredible happened in the era of 1914. But they don't know what happened. It takes the eye of faith to know what happened. You know, before we look at the details of what happened, we should remind ourselves, why did this image exist at all? Why did this situation, which was represented by the image, exist at all? Why did this succession of world governments exist at all? You know the answer. God was allowing mankind to try and govern himself. God was letting mankind have the leash, so to speak. I said leash, not lease. You could say it either way. God was allowing man to rule himself. And again, in his incredible efficiency, at the same time, he was selecting the church class while this was all going on. This attempt at self-rule by the Gentile powers, Israel had already proved they could not rule themselves. And now the Gentiles were given a chance. This was part of an educational process. And they had to learn that it was futile to try to govern themselves. And they had to learn that the only remedy was God's kingdom. So now we look at this image, and it's struck by a stone.
as we think of that event and we think of this dream, there's an image. And it's there in one moment. And if we jump ahead a few more moments, it's gone. This represents an incredible change. Something tremendous is here. In a couple moments, something tremendous is gone. So we must look at history. We must look for something tremendous being there one moment. And several moments later, it's gone. We must keep in time. Again, our moments with God need to be spread out. Something tremendous is going to be there. And with some drama, something tremendous will be gone. We would expect that great thing to be there to have something to do with the Gentiles, with their rulership. We know from the dream that there's a succession, Babylon to Greece, Medo-Persia to Greece, to Rome, Gentile powers ruling the earth, and finally the mixture of clay and iron. And I found the New International Translation interesting because it said baked clay. And we know how brittle baked clay can be. For a long time in my mind, I had thought of a more malleable, wet clay mixed with the iron, and that wouldn't be quite as brittle. This was a tremendous brittle situation. We would expect that that image would exist, that the rulership representing monarchies, empires, emperors, kings and queens, all absolute rulers, we would expect that style of rulership to exist for a long period of time. The image shows us, and as we look at history, we see the parallel of absolute rulers. We also see in this absolutism territorial concepts of these handful of governments. And we would expect no change until the stone arrives. Each of them in their day, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome, ruled the entire world. In the early days, the known world was small. And even we might say in the case of Rome, it did not include the world as we see it. But they were the dominant single force in their world. We would expect, because of the prediction of the dream, that the absolute rulers who rule the entire earth would be there one day, and in very quick succession, there would be a change. What we see with this Gentile lease of powers, a handful of people controlling the world. In some cases, there was only one man, and he ruled the whole world. Other times, there were four, five, six people. And as we have the picture of Daniel in our minds, we would expect no change in that system of world rulership until the stone arrives. Some dramatic event, some death blow to this concept that had existed for hundreds and hundreds of years. Now let's look at what causes the death blow. It's a stone. And Daniel says that this stone grows into a great mountain which fills the earth. Ah, there's the first clue. Did you hear what it fills? It fills the earth. I think it's probably significant that it does not fill heaven and earth. It tells us that probably this is a picture just of the earthly operation. This is not such a huge picture that we're talking about all the ecclesiastical heavens. We're not talking about the ages to come and the other mansions. This is a picture about the earth and what's going to happen to this creation. We notice that it's stone. All the other things were metal. So there's a significant change there. I'm not sure totally what it means. We know there are scriptures that relate to stone and rock, meaning truth. As we look at this from a physical point of view, the metals are processed. You have to process silver and ore. You have to process gold, to process things to get iron, to use it to make a dazzling statue. And you know, we don't think that much of processed things nowadays, do we? We want the natural. One point might be is that the stone is more natural. It's not a processed metal. The metals tend to be rare. You only find gold in certain places. Silver only in certain places. But stone is everywhere. That's another advantage of the kingdom stone, being a stone. It's going to be everywhere. It's not an elitist concept of, oh, gold or a little bit of silver. No, it's everywhere. The stone of this kingdom will fill the earth. And in other respects, the values of the metals used in the image, the gold, the silver, the copper, those are man-made values. Gold in this earth only has value because of man's exchange and man's selfishness. And really, a gold mountain, although it's brilliant, is not a symbol of strength. Gold is a soft metal. Silver is a soft metal. So is copper and even iron compared to a mountain is nothing. What we see in this great mountain, which fills, first of all, the earth and its stone, it's made of stone, in keeping with this image, which is talking about rulership, the idea continues. This mountain is another symbol of rulership. This is, in fact, the next universal empire. Babylon was a universal empire. Greece was a, Medo-Persia was a universal empire. Greece was a universal empire. Rome was a universal empire. There's another one. And that's what this story tells us about. The next universal empire, God's universal empire. We see that the stone that strikes the image develops into this world empire. It ends up being the world empire. Now, certain forces and certain personalities and certain groups help that develop into the universal empire, but they are not in themselves that universal empire or mountain. An example of this is the returned Christ. He certainly is responsible for this mountain being created, but he is not the mountain. Christ is Christ. The mountain is the kingdom here on earth. The church class develops into a spiritual administration of this mountain. The church is not the mountain. The mountain is here on earth. The church is going to be in the heavens. So we see that this picture is many faceted. It includes many things. You can't just say it is Christ. You can't just say it is Christ and the church. Nor can you just say it's just the kingdom here on earth. It's a dominion. It's a rulership. It's a big picture as to what's going to take place here on the earth. It's the authority of the next universal empire. we note that even the key dates that are associated with the Lord's return, for example, 1874, they do not coincide with the date of the striking of the image, which is 1914. Nor does the date of the completion of the church coincide with the striking of the image. I had a card here that had the date of the completion of the church, but I seem to have misplaced it. So you'll have to wait till I find that card. But what we saw happen in 1914 was the beginning. Like we said before, God works in processes. It would be unrealistic to expect everything to change in 1 year. So we have seen, since that time period, changes in the world. Before 1914, there was a worldwide dominion of just a handful of colonial powers. They were empires. And in 1914, they began to dismantle. One by one, the empires were dismantled. You know, if you were going to dismantle a house and renovate it and restore it, you would do it in a slow, step-by-step manner. You wouldn't exactly dynamite the whole thing. That would certainly be an option. But that's not the process that's going on. No, first of all, the inhabitants would be moved out, and then the dismantling process would take place board by board, and then, in the same sense, the restoration would start. Starting in 1914, the world exploded towards self-determination. They were tired. They'd had enough of the absolute rule of the Gentile times. The German Empire, which was one of the major portions of the Holy Roman Empire, it covered over 1 million square miles. After the war of 1914, the German Empire was reduced to 180,000 square miles. That major portion of the image was 15% of what it was just a few years earlier. The same thing happened to the Austro-Hungary Empire. That particular empire lost 3/4 of its people. 75% of the people it ruled were gone. Countries like Turkey, the territory was cut in half. Turkish rule was over 20 million people. 1914, in a matter of a year or two, they were down to half that size. New republics were created. Man created these little small new countries: Czechoslovakia, Poland, Yugoslavia, Finland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, the Irish Free State. The theme was self-determination. They were tired of the despot rule. The old nations didn't totally disappear. They were carved up and looked a little different. The grinding process. First, you noticed in the account that the image was struck, then it was ground to pieces. That was taking time. And in Daniel, the 7th chapter, the New English Version says, "The rest of the beasts," and I would suggest this applies to after it's been struck, "the rest of the beasts, though deprived of their sovereignty, were allowed to remain alive for a time in a season." That's what happened to the Gentile powers in 1914. They were deprived of their sovereignty, but their lives continued on as the process of the grinding continued. In these fragments of the image, there were still some efforts that man had to make to see if he could rule himself. Yes, the Gentile kings had been given the right to rule, But that wasn't enough options. Men could come up with other ideas to rule themselves. So once the Gentile lease of power was ended, new ideas came in. One of the next attempts that needed to fail, needed to first be tried, then needed to fail before God's kingdom could be established, was fascism. This was a totalitarian concept. It wasn't much different than that absolute rule of the kings. But this time, instead of kings and a genetic succession of a royal family, no, men said, we can rule ourselves with the same power, but we just want to pick the men ourselves. We want to pick ourselves. So these were power-hungry men who exploited their fellow men with a strong central government. Men like Mussolini, Hitler, Franco. These governments exposed man's inability to govern man again. They exposed the hatefulness of men governing men. God allowed them to try this modification of the absolute rule of the Gentile times. But the kingdom stone had struck. And these men tried. They showed that they couldn't do it. And fascism failed. And when fascism failed, the kingdom stone grew a little bit larger. But there was something else that man had to try in his ideas. And this was called socialism. Socialism had to be tried and had to fail. Great Britain is probably the best example of socialism on the face of this earth. It was certainly one of the empire toes of that great image. They embraced socialism. It has failed. One of the world's greatest empires has shriveled to a third-rate power because their energy has been sapped by socialism. All around the world, the trappings of socialism, which are so bogged down in expense, inefficiency, and corruption, that government after government in our day and age is replacing socialism with another attempt. It's called private enterprise, free enterprise. Socialism was a benevolent attempt of man governing man. Man was going to take care of man. But socialism failed. And the kingdom stone grows a little larger. Have you seen the kingdom stone? Did you see it strike the monarchies in 1914? Did you see it strike fascism in 1945? Did you see it in the demise of socialism in the 1980s? You know, the world sees it too. But they don't know what's going on. But by the eye of faith, we see this kingdom stone. But it's not finished yet. Another form of government that had to be tried and had to fail was communism. Again, this was a working together. If we all pool our resources, we don't need God's kingdom. So since the 1920s, this was another totalitarian type approach of managing fellow man. This one promised the benefits of socialism with the efficiency of fascism and almost a monarchy rule. This was 3% of the people ruling everyone else. And now, in our lifetime, almost in the space of 1 year, almost overnight, we have seen the downfall of communism. The kingdom stone has struck another attempt of mankind, and the kingdom stone grows. The communistic countries are in economic and political chaos. Brethren, if you weren't around in 1914, if you didn't see what happened in 1945 to fascism, if you can't remember what happened to socialism in the 80s,
Certainly you have seen the kingdom stone smash one of the strongest ideological ideas Satan has ever come up with for replacing God's kingdom. Communism was going to do it all. Satan had millions of people believing that communism was the answer. But the watchword now is democracy. And since 1914, the world has gone towards self-determination. Every man, self-determination. Don't be fooled. Democracy is not the last step. Democracy is not the fifth universal empire. The world must also learn that despite all the advantages, democracy is not a substitute for God's kingdom. Democracy must fail also and give way to the fifth universal empire. What will come next? You can see it already in the countries that have been democratic for a long period of time. Countries that have been democratic for over 200 years. Read my lips. United States of America. You can see it in our schools. You can see it in our corporations. You can see it in our legislatures. Everything is breaking into smaller and smaller fragments. The two-party system is gone. Representative democracy, where we would send someone to Washington, it's gone. Everybody wants to vote for themselves. Everything is participative. It's consensus. But the selfishness, the greed, all these things will make this attempt a failure. What we see in our schools and the corporations are the seeds of anarchy, chaos, no rule. Every man will be an island to himself. Government will be impossible. The entire world must go through this process. The people in Romania now think that democracy is the solution. They're wrong. The kingdom stone grows as man's attempts abort and fail. And the grinding of that stone will continue until every man-made idea and option has failed. Glasnost, perestroika, disarmament, diplomacy must all fail. And because you are living in the last days, you have been privileged to see these things take place before your eyes. Let the drama and the clarity of the world events inspire you to more vigorously fulfill your vows of consecration, that you continue to sacrifice the flesh and its interests, that you may attain unto the heavenly inheritance and join heirship with our Redeemer. Amen.
We have seen the kingdom stone.